You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. Now, if you guys haven't had the opportunity to check out the Navigator Series, it's a brand new lineup from Lacrosse. They have the Windrose for men and women. They also have the Atlas, and that's what I wore during my rut vacation this fall. Check them out. They're very comfortable. It's a traditional rubber boot, kind of mixed with a traditional hunting hiking boot. They've mashed it together, and the outcome is the Navigator Series. Check it out at lacrossefootwear.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Welcome back.
And you know, it is a wonderful time of the year. It's Christmas time. It's December, and you know, there's a lot of guys, like the guy who's coming on. December is an amazing time to hunt.
Ooh.
But it's also just an amazing time of the year, and appreciative. You should be very appreciative of what's occurring at this time of the year with Christmas coming up.
Yep.
It's a good time to spend with family and friends.
Just got off the heels of Thanksgiving, and I don't know what the deal is, but I feel like I'm in more in the Christmas like spirit or mood this year than I have been so many years like prior to this. And I don't know what the deal is, but I really am feeling. I used to
Did
never.
Did you go
listen.
To Silver Dollars? You went to Silver Dollars. Yeah. That'll get you.
Oh my gosh! It really has kind of. What is the cheerometer?
Yeah, the cheerometer. Yeah.
It's going up. But I legit found myself listening to Christmas music the other day. I'm like, who am I?
Oh,
what is going on?
I had it on during gun season. But I love Christmas. And this year,
and the jingle bells on the boots.
You know, we're recording this. It's late at night. And it's actually my daughter's birthday, number one for her.
Mm-hmm.
So Christmas in this time of year has a whole new celebration for me.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a great time of the year, but you know, as we start ramping up for 2020, there is some things we want to discuss before we jump into the podcast with Mr. Seth Harker.
Yeah, for sure. This is well, and we kind of hinted at it last week.
Yeah,
last week we
discussed
about
a little bit on it.
Virtual property valuations, a new way that we can work with landowners maybe who don't have the ability to get us on site. That's a great option. So if you want to hear more about that, go check out last week's podcast. But what we hinted about was the fact of our ability to be able to work with people through real estate, whether they're buying and or selling.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, we've done quite a few podcasts talking about real estate, just in general, the highs, the lows, the you know, what to look for in a property.
What to avoid, too.
Yeah,
scared of.
Yeah,
what
skeptical.
Listings may go, okay,
yeah.
I don't buy it.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot to that. And we feel like that experience from the real estate side of things has allowed us to share and have a different perspective with clients who are using us from a land management standpoint. Because not everybody, when we talk about goals of a property, you know, they might not always be recreational. They may be in, whether it's an investment or they might have an income standpoint. So for us to be able to speak with them, we need to be knowledgeable of all that. So in doing real estate here locally in Missouri and having the ability to talk with people across the country, work with them in so many different states, what we've done in the building of Land and Legacy, and this is one of those things I think as we got started, it was, we're going to get there. We're going to do this, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but from early on, this was one of those things that we're going to do that and we're going to get there, but we need to build not only ourselves, but the people that we reach and the network that we're going to be able to utilize and feel comfortable utilizing to help these people.
Absolutely. I think, you know, when you look at a new company that's kind of in this outdoorish realm of hunting and things like that, which we are. I mean, we would say natural resource management, but a lot of our clients are hunting-minded. So the outdoor industry is kind of something that we're in.
We got one foot in, one foot out.
Yeah, pretty much. Some days it's more on one side versus the other. But
we're a fence straddler.
You know, if you look at it, it's like we don't have a long list of sponsors because, you know, we've worked with.
It's not our model.
It's not our model, and it hasn't been our ambition from the start. Our ambition has been help landowners improve their land.
Yeah.
And through real estate, through consulting, through the podcast, through videos that are now becoming more regular. And, you know, guys, go check out the YouTube channel because we started putting more vlogs on late this summer, but you're going to see a lot more this winter on exactly how to do bedding thickets, how to hinge cut for good
edge
and bad,
feathering,
different things that you're going to be doing this winter and why it's important. That's all going to the YouTube channel coming up. So go over there, subscribe, please. Another way you can support us. But we've always been, how can we help and make the biggest impact? Not how can we make the most money from sponsorships, but how can we help people from the get-go on improving their land and enjoying that more with their family and friends. And, you know, the real estate side, I said this a lot, but, you know, if you talk to a lot of real estate agents, they're going to say, get the listings, and that's how you do it. But I've always enjoyed the buying side of helping somebody try to find their dream farm. And this is an opportunity for us to help people find that dream farm and avoid some of the costly mistakes of maybe buying a property, not realizing how much work is ahead of you, how many invasive species were present when that you didn't realize were present when you bought the place. And so now you're trying to, let's say, get quail or more turkeys, and we would recommend you need to remove all this so you have better habitat. You could avoid those headaches by letting us help you.
Or just purchasing this other farm.
Or purchasing this other farm, yeah. And so there's a lot of ways we can help you. And one of the biggest things that about this virtual property tours and this kind of going into this real estate consulting side is that it's not costing you. It's not set up to where to help for us to help you on the real estate side that you have to fork over or pay our consulting fee if it's kind of that. You know, you think of the consulting and it's a straight up front cost and to get us there. But with this, there's a way that we can work to where our commission in the real estate is how we're helping you.
There's no like upfront, hey guys, how much does this cost? There's not a flat fee. It's based off of commission. And so we are licensed in the state of Missouri, but from any agent in any state has the ability to refer business. So guys, if you're out there listening and you are looking to purchase land or you are looking to sell land, we can still help you. We may not be the person who is signing that paperwork, but through the process, through that transaction, we can still provide you all our knowledge from the land side of things. It's not going to be in, okay, how much should I pay for this property? That's not necessarily where we come in, but from our real estate background, we have the ability to guide and direct, and we want to be used as a sounding board because we have seen many people go through a real estate transaction, and then maybe they could have avoided all these issues that they're now facing by just selecting a different property.
Or, I mean, short story, we look at a farm and we see the farm, we see the shape it's in, and then it gets listed and there's food plots and all the trail cam images and deer, and you're going, we've been all over that property and there was not a single food plot.
Misrepresentation.
How is that? And then saying it's been whatever, the verbiage is very untrue.
Yeah.
And so that's very important to really avoid costly mistakes.
Yeah, because there's unfortunately, probably in any industry, there is the smoke and mirrors, unfortunately, and the representation of properties. So in a nutshell, reach out to us. Let us know if you're interested in us assisting you in finding that property, as well as working with you as a sounding board through that entire process.
Yeah.
Come to us. We will link you up with an agent that we have experience with and that has come highly recommended, whether our clients have worked with them in that state. Let's just say a gentleman from North Carolina reaches out. Yep. Says, hey guys, I want to purchase land in Ohio. Okay, great. Let us help you. Tell us your area. Give us this information. We have an agent that we have, you know, Adam and I, Land and Legacy, has already identified in that area and said, hey, we want to work with you. We want to refer our business over to you. You'll be the gentleman who, you know, does all the paperwork, you know, runs through the transactions and assists that client financially through that, you know, avenue of real estate. But we want to help them and just identify and be a sounding board and refer that business to you. So through the years, I don't know how many states and agents we have met, but
pile of them,
they're not all created equal. And it doesn't matter what brokerage either. we have people from brokerages most likely people have never even heard of, or the most common brokerages out there. Yeah. What we wanted to find in this building of the service is the right agent in the right state to be able to help you that we feel confident is going to represent you fairly and allow us to do our job in working with you.
Honest and is of high integrity as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we have people right now, prior to marketing or talking about this with you guys, who have gone through this process with us already and who are going through it right now. So, you know, this is something that we would like to be able to help and know that we can because of the people who have already gone through it and the people who are going through it right now, and knowing that, guys, at the end of the day, your goals and objectives are is what we're basing our information and our recommendations off of.
Oh, for
whether
sure.
Whether it's this property, that property, you know, that area, not as great. Maybe you're looking at that zone in this state. Well, you need to consider this. Just an overall, anything, everything, could be natural resource related, access.
Is it
access
enrolled in government contracts, government
absolutely
programs to where you're going to be tied? Oh, wow, the price per acre is really low,
but
it's enrolled. Yeah.
When your hands are tied.
Yeah. Or, you know, I just did a showing this week where it was one of those you sent over to me. Somebody was just getting ready. It was like it was going to be listed. It was coming soon, I think.
Right.
And you sent it over, and we both were like, "Woo!" We look all over for habitat like that.
Yeah.
For that type of ecosystem. You know, it's one of those where you could roll up and say, it's just overgrown fields.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, if you bought a property that was straight timber in the same county, you'd be doing a lot of stuff trying to get that same kind of habitat on the timber property when you could just get it at a lower price on the old field property because old fields don't look like they would bring as much, or they wouldn't bring as much money per acre on the market, but yet it's going to be providing better habitat for your wildlife. So if you're looking for recreational property, that would be something we would steer you for rather than trying to go with the mature timber property.
No, absolutely.
Depending on what the price per acre in the area you're at.
Yeah, and that's the thing of, you know, we come at this from I want to think very, very critically of all these different resources or issues, the pros and cons of each property, and let you know straight up. Because whether you're in Georgia and you're looking for property in Missouri or Kansas or whatever, before you make a trip out to actually see it, you better have a really good feeling of committing to that travel and say, these are the three properties that I've worked with the guys at Land and Legacy to help identify, and I'm coming to see them. By the end of that, these are the top three. We're going to have a property, hopefully under contract, that we can utilize that agent that they said was great and that we're holding ourselves to, and we're going to come out of this thing where we want to be and make sure that all said and done, our goals can be reached on that property.
Absolutely.
And
for
so
sure.
That's the big thing, guys. Allow us to help you find the right properties. So there is a whole new tab on the website, Real Estate Consulting. Go there, click it. Same thing that you would with a consultation.
Agents that listen to this, if you guys are interested in working with us, we'd love to shoot us an email as well, and so we can get to know you and maybe add you to our list once we get to know you of Maybe you're in an area we haven't worked yet, or and it's an area that we're going to need to be working.
Sure.
You know, we'd love to hear from you so we can kind of put you in the system and get to know you a little better. So info@LandonLegacy.tv.
Or if you have a property that you're like, guys, this is the one, it hasn't sold yet, share it with us. We have people who email in often and who are looking for properties just like that. Let us know. Send it our way. We would love to look at it and add it to a long list of properties that we've got our eye on that someone needs to get in there and buy.
For sure. Man, yeah. There's some properties that we see a lot that it's like, oh, my gosh. We're in an area of the world where it's not like a big destination where you see a lot of guys, a lot of outdoor television shows coming in buying up land
to
manage and grow giant deer. But you can grow giant deer. I mean, Donuts is a great case of that. But, man, there's some properties where we're like, oh, my gosh, I wish I had a bag. What did you say the other day?
A briefcase full of money.
Yeah, because we'd buy that farm right now.
I'd show up to the closing table? No.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's a lot
send
of those properties.
Send over the offer and tell them I'm a cash buyer.
But there's a lot of those opportunities out there, guys. And this is the other way that we can be able to help you guys. So you'll be hearing quite a bit, probably some testimonies on the podcast of this service from people in the coming months and the coming years as what all this entails, the ins and outs, and how it has helped them and their land purchasing over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So
it's a direction that we've been wanting to go for a while.
Yep.
We're finally of a time where we feel comfortable enough to be able to launch that and really do a big and to be able to handle all of it.
Because
I think it could bring a lot of interaction and we'd be able to help many people find their dream farm.
Yeah.
I mean, we get these emails all the time from guys who are saying, hey, my wife and I just closed on our first farm. It's been a lifelong dream. And it's like, man, I'm so happy for those people. I want to be there to help more people, though, find that farm. Because there has been clients and other people that email us in. And it's like, man, I bought a farm and there's so much work ahead of me to try to get rid of the invasive species or whatever.
What's one of the – I got two things before we move on. What's one of the things that – you always hear a landowner say when they just bought a property and then they start in and they're like, whoa, wait a second. What did I do?
I don't know what you're asking.
They got excited.
Oh, yeah. They bought off emotion.
Off emotion.
Yeah.
And that's what we want to – not that emotion is bad. You should have emotion with every property and every purchase. You should be absolutely in love with it, but you shouldn't – be in love with it so much that you ignore the cons and ignore
that's
the bad
thing.
That's
a huge one. Yeah, for sure. Buying off emotion, managing with emotion. Like, emotion is great, but it should be way – you should have a small piece of the pie, if you're looking at a pie graph, should be emotion because
these things have to be very critical decision. And honestly, sometimes that third party
absolutely.
Who isn't, let's say, putting their name on the deed – that balancing act, that sounding board, that's us. That's where we want to be. We want to provide that assistance with you guys.
We've had several that have been like, I wish I would have done this in a more business mindset. I wish I hadn't have got so much emotion involved in it.
Wrapped
and we don't have any emotion involved in it. We can just shoot you straight and tell you, hey, this is what you're up against. This is what you're going to face. This is what we'd recommend. And it's even easy to fall in love with the pictures before you ever even see the place. Like,
that
farm that we just spoke on, being an old field, it looks a lot different in person than what the pictures look like.
I bet.
And you're like, this, I mean, the pictures, it's not that the agent's hiding anything. It's just, it looks a whole lot different.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that a lot where it's like, man, this farm is way worse in person than it is in the pictures.
Oh, yeah.
This farm's way better in the picture or in person than it is. We see
that
more than anything. And that's where like, depending on the agent and the brokerage, where you're going, okay, well.
We want fair representation.
This farm looks terrible in the listing, but let's go. Yeah. It's got a good price breaker. And you show up and you're like, they don't know what they have.
Don't look excited. Don't look excited.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest values is because this would be most likely, most people's cases, the very start of a property transformation, when we're able to come in from the commission side of things and work with you from that start, we're able then to look at a consultation differently and most likely provide a nice discount
yeah.
on a consultation service afterwards. Once you've
signed
the deed.
If they
want
to go that route sure. and get the full plan or get the consultation.
Then we can provide that absolute direct plan. Guys, this is what you follow. This is how you make it happen. But initially, we want to be that step so you don't make the wrong mistake in the purchase process. So
another thing, too, is eyeing the neighborhood. Sometimes there's certain things that you'll see that you can go, you know, this gravel road is way more active than it may appear. There's certain things about this gravel road that makes me go, ooh, there's wide open views into your property through here. You know, if there's another property that's screened off or not like this, maybe it's a better option. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, I don't know if you've noticed, but there are several things around the property that make this look like it gets hunted really, really hard.
Yep.
And I don't know if you can tell, but that's a big bottleneck between your farm and that big chunk of national mm-hmm. forest. And the neighbor in between's got a shooting house on both sides, so he's yeah. going to gun them down.
Yeah.
And things like that are definitely some things that can be overlooked.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And from the – we're real estate agents, so I can say this. From the real estate side, if you're a listing agent, you don't mention those because you're like, you know, you're like, I don't really – that could be a kill – that could be a deal buster. Like, this is the property. It's listed – you know,
yeah, that's
make your observation. Yeah, make your observations. Yeah. All I know about is this property.
Yeah.
But if we're coming into it from helping you on the buying side, we can be like, you know, this is some stuff you need to consider.
Need to evaluate this. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep. So
there's a lot that goes into it. So guys, if you are interested, go to that tab, send in through that contact sheet. Send in the information, and we're going to get on the phone with you guys. We're going to really try and understand exactly what it is you're looking for. This is going to be a working, evolving thing. It doesn't happen overnight. The best purchases most likely don't, but you need to be ready to strike when the iron is hot and when the right property comes available. So we look forward to working with you guys if you're interested. And so just let us know, and if you need to, contact through social media as well. What's Seth talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, we're getting ready to hear Seth.
Oh, he just killed another deer. Another deer.
The heck with that guy.
With 8-inch bases.
Yeah, 8 1/8 or something like that.
7 7/8 and 8 1/8.
God.
Yeah.
What did it score?
Gross with some extras, 163.
Really?
Yes.
That mass just bump that deer up.
Is pretty impressive. Yeah, not incredible time length. Good beams. He's tall,
yeah.
But he's not tall from his tines. But the mass is just incredible.
Yeah,
incredible.
He said
that
when that deer showed up, he said it almost looks like his bases. They're not too much. There's not too much of a gap between his bases touching.
No, on a mature deer's forehead.
Yeah,
mature deer. If you've not been around them, they're wide and they're almost touching.
Unbelievable.
And that doesn't happen a lot here in Southern Missouri.
And it sounds like an unbelievable hunt.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Crazy, crazy hunt. And stuff that you wouldn't normally think of occurring in late season. So it's a longer podcast, but guys, hopefully you'll enjoy the story, and there's a lot of good tidbits in there too to be able to take home and not underestimate the power of hunting in December, like we started the podcast off with.
Seth is a really, really good hunter, and he's done it for a long time, and
he knows
if
his
you
properties.
Sit down and chat with him, he's got some ideas that sometimes, like him and I, we talk all the time about this sort of thing. And it's a little bit, it's things you don't hear talked about a lot or mention in articles or in other blogs. And he's just got little unique ways of hunting his specific property
mm-hmm.
that I think anybody could pick up. And you know, I don't know if you
use
talk about
not.
It. Because it's just an interview with you and him, but talked about hunting this food plot. Took him years to figure out which wind to hunt it on.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a thing that I think anybody could deal with if you're hunting food plots, especially in terrain country. You're going, you know, it makes sense to hunt it on this wind, but the way the wind moves through the hills, I have to hunt it on complete opposite of what I'm thinking, and that's the way it now is successful.
And that's exactly what happened. He saw probably the most deer he's seen all season on a hunt pretty much over a food plot, but pretty much just in the timber.
Gotcha. Well, guys, I hope you enjoy it. All right.
All right, Seth, are you there?
I'm here.
Perfect, perfect. Well, everyone's got the introduction, and they're ready for the story. Every time you come on, I think everyone's ready for just the story of success from an awesome hunt that you had the privilege of having. And so let's just lay it out there. You killed a fantastic deer late season, pretty much the first time in on this deer. Let's break it down. Let's understand how this hunt went through, what the preparation was, what the story, the history of this deer. Give us those details, and hopefully by the end of this, and hopefully I think by people really understanding, let's say you, what you're looking for as a hunter in individual deer, that they can then take these, let's say the key points, the high points from this podcast, and go back and listen to all the other ones we've ever recorded with you, take those high points and really realize that deer are individuals, and to kill them and harvest them effectively on a year-in and year-out basis, you have to know those details. And this podcast is probably going to be no different, but it's interesting how you observe, witness, and see these different features and then use that to your advantage. So let's hear it.
So, well, the story's about a buck we call Dirty Harry. And one thing to note is he showed up month of December, last of November, and didn't recognize the deer probably at first. Then the wheels get to turning, we get to looking at past history, and then I get to pick up a set of sheds that I had picked up, and I'm like, and looking at trail pictures and personality, I'm like, hey, this is Dirty Harry. His personality traits fit the bases of the deer, which is what was really unique about the deer off the sheds. Probably him as a 3-year-old, possibly 4-year-old. I look at those sheds there and I'm like, oh yeah, this is the deer, and observe the trail photos, and we're like, this is the deer.
Right.
So he showed up, and as you well know, the back of the 360, and conversations, Matt and I talk a lot, past conversations. I don't know if you remember, Matt, we talked about how things were kind of skewed in the way the deer were actually moving around the property.
Right.
Community scrapes that were traditional that I could bet the farm that you put a trail camera there, put fresh batteries in it, come back and get it. The scrape's going to be as big as a truck hood, and you're going to have all these images of great bucks, typically just one you don't know, comes in, goes out. I mean, it's just an awesome location. So that's what we probably observed earlier, was the transition. If you remember, you mentioned that it could be because we were in the second year of that massive TSI, because that's
right,
where a lot of the action was around, definitely, was that TSI second year, all the food. And I think that's a great observation and probably really accurate, because that's definitely where the bulk of the sign, trail camera photos, and things like that were. And where we killed Dirty Harry, that was just 200 yards from this.
Sure.
But interestingly enough, probably what led me to really getting back here, I actually had went back to pull a camera off a community scrape, had put it up, and it's one I just leave there, and I thought, okay, what do I have here at this scrape? And the scrape was probably as big as a basketball. Didn't look like anything had been there. There had been very few deer there. And I was like, what in the world? Why is this little piece of pie right here not being used? So we kind of transitioned back, and I started noticing, but closer I got to that the clear cut, I started noticing all the turkey scratchings in there and red oak acorn.
Right, right.
So I noticed that, and the greenbrier. I quickly moved a camera. I moved it on another scrape. I kind of did an excursion, moved that on a scrape, and we picked up a few deer, a few that I didn't know. And in the tree, the scrape tree, I actually noticed this deer's bases. I was like, "Ooh, boy, I've got to try to get more images of this." Lo and behold, the deer just moved into one of our furthest back food plots. And he just kind of started making this his home for whatever reason.
Walk us through that date time frame that you started seeing this, because it's, you know, when we're talking history here, this all really kind of transpired pretty rapidly from, hey, I'm getting pictures of this deer. I'm not positive who it is. There might be some history, but, you know, maybe a couple of weeks come by and then you get the right wind, you're in there. When did you start getting pictures of this deer?
Oh, probably 2 weeks. I mean, what's today?
Right, Thanksgiving time frame. If I'm not mistaken, that week of Thanksgiving, I think.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago is when, and that's what's interesting about it. It was like, I mean, it was just like, bam. I mean, this part of the farm, and we'll talk about it later, but I got to see why, and we kind of let in a little hint here, but it just became a magnet. I mean, the deer were just so focused, just right in this section right here. In fact, the buffet, and that's really what got me looking too, because the buffet is generally, as you know, in the past, I mean,
which is a large food plot for everyone else who's listening. It's a pretty big food plot in the center of this property that pulls a ton of deer, and it is just always just a central hub for this property to be able to check and categorize. And you're always checking cameras this time of the year daily and it's usually on the buffet, that food plot, because you never know when that right deer is going to show up at this time of the year.
Right.
So it's a hot spot.
It's a hot spot, always has been. It's a historic spot. And again, you mentioned checking trail cameras daily. And, you know, I know that's a controversy probably. One reason that I probably was because I almost paused here because I don't want to say, because I'm sitting here wondering who's listening about this. But I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. When I was hunting Whiplash, I had an encounter with just an absolute giant. And that is actually probably who I was really looking for targeting. Don't have any trail camera images of the deer, just an absolute monster whitetail buck. Anyway, long story short, that's probably who I was looking for. But as whitetail hunting goes, a bird in hand is better than one in the bush. And
for sure,
I had a little bit of history with Dirty Harry and kind of started putting things together. So we started going off of him. But what really threw me was, I'm like, why are these deer not really utilized? I mean, I've got a great food plot in here. Why are they not utilizing the buffet, and why is everything towards the southern end? And basically, my cameras reveal, I've got another one down in the bottom, like where the clear cut actually starts, or the TSI, if you will. And I'm getting lots of daylight pictures headed to the edge of the TSI and then back up to the south and back around. But they're not going that extra 200 yards and looping in the buffet. And I'm like, what in the world? Why not? I mean,
sure,
you can kill all these deer on the buffet. It's like, I mean, that's where you kill the big deer in December, is on the buffet.
Yep.
And it was hot earlier.
That's where you killed Whiplash, just, you know, beginning of November.
Right. I mean, it was hot earlier. And I think the depletion of acorns in our area, I think that section on the edge of the TSI where we were at, I think it had the largest concentration of acorns left in our area.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually contribute.
Go ahead. Keep going. I was going to interrupt.
I was going to say I actually contribute that to our timber work and actually logging practices, because those trees are huge. We logged it out. The logger did it right. The trees are just huge logs, no limbs. They're canopied out. And when he cut them, I remember his exact words. He said, "Seth, I inventoried these trees. I did it right." And he goes, "These trees are going to be some top acorn producers someday." And as you look through there, it's just, you know, it was ugly, terrible at first. But now you look through there and it's restoring and it's really becoming a beautiful, beautiful scene.
Sure. And I think that, you know, for those who aren't familiar with the property, you know, you drive through, you're getting, initially quite a bit of, thick, dense cover, a lot more recent, let's say, timber practices have been done at the beginning of the property. The further you transition, and in years like this year, where you have in our area a large red oak mast crop, you're going to have these years where deer do different things than what they typically do and are on, because, you know, the top end of the farm, it's got more white oak, I believe, on the top end and and around some of the best producers, probably in and around the edges of the buffet and the clear cut area. But the farther you transition back, you really get into a lot of the black oak, red oak, so the later maturing acorns. And it's pretty stark difference as you walk back through there. And you know, again, knowing that the mass production changed this year and was very heavily skewed towards the red oaks, this is the time the year when the red oaks are very dominant. There's no wonder that they're back there, you know. It takes that scouting, though, even during the middle of season that you're doing. You're like you said, hey, I took a little excursion. I took a little bit of time to go and circle around and try and put some of these pieces together. You can't just rely on a stationary camera that you've put out in September and just turn it on, pull the cards every week to tell you what the deer are doing from September all the way to January. Food sources change, behavior changes, so you too have to change the way that you're monitoring that and evaluating it to make sure that, hey, when a good deer does show up that you don't know, you kind of, I think what you would phrase it, blitz that area, figure it out. 2 weeks later, you're holding this deer, story's ended because you were successful. But, you know, in a monitoring situation, I would say, Seth, that you're probably more aggressive in monitoring it and figuring out the answers than most people are in the middle of season, because it's, you know, oh, you can't go in there, you can't be doing this, you can't be doing that. Well, if you don't, you'll never get the full picture and you won't have a deer to show. You won't be successful. Would you say that's accurate?
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. And I am very aggressive. Typically late season, I am very aggressive. One reason I'm aggressive is because the deer are depleted. And I will tell you, I feel like it is hard. Now, you can make them nocturnal, but I feel like it is really hard to beat them off a good food source. And we've got corn, we've got beans, we've got alfalfa, we've got, you know, we've got everything that they need, and they utilize all of that. Everything that we have, they use. And I just made it a point I was running all my cameras. We had a job close by, which made it easier for me. But I made it a point to run all of my cameras other than the Cuddy Links. Property's too big to get all my Cuddy Links without having probably three plans.
Yep.
Possibly four plans. So I used my Cuddy Links, which actually cut me down a lot of my checking time, and I'm so thankful for that.
Oh, I bet.
But my other cameras that I have, the other cameras that I have to run, I actually were running every day.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like December, the first week of December, the first, second week of December, I feel like big mature deer are sometimes at their most vulnerable point.
Let's break that down for a quick second as to why. Let you explain it and then kind of come back in. But give us your take on why December 1 through the 12th, 14th is a really, really good time to target and try and pattern big mature whitetails.
So historically for me, what I've observed is if you can find the food source that they are on, whether it be beans, corn, red oak acorns, buck, I mean, whatever the case may be, what happens is they are depleted from rutting. Some of them are. We can talk about different personalities, but for the most part, some of them more than others, but they are really depleted from the rut, from participating in the rut. And a good food source, I'm telling you, they will come to it at noon. They will come to it in the morning. They will come to it in the evening, wherever they're at. They're going to come through and be almost probably, well, I know they are, more so than they are at any other time versus a really cold winter, late season in our area. But that is, you can almost bank on that even with warmer temperatures. And that's probably why I try to key on that window, because if we don't get cold weather for the late part of December, then they get kind of built back up, replenished, and it takes really cold weather to get them on their feet. But that first 2 weeks, you're really focusing on not so much weather. I mean, weather helps, but you're just focusing on, hey, they've been running, they've been gunning, and it doesn't matter whether it's hot. It doesn't matter whether it's cold. One thing's for certain, they're going to come in and they're going to try to replenish their energy from just running the month of November.
Yeah, I think
so. That's why I try to key in on that.
I think you summed that up really well. It's more or less of just, hey, I've kind of hit rock bottom. I got to get back up. You know, there's a lot of research that has found, you know, deer can lose up to 20 to 25% of their body mass during the month of November through the rut, through, you know, tough winters, stuff like that. So, you know, as soon as they're coming out of that, you know, intense chasing, intense rutting activity, they just got to get that let's say bottom level cranked back up, so they're hitting these food sources intensely, they're hitting it hard, and that's why you then too are aggressive. You're matching that aggressiveness with your scouting and your ability to try and take in information, find out who's doing what, where they're doing it, and get in there, because they're very vulnerable at this time of the year. And it's a special window, like you said, because we're in the middle latitude of really the whitetail's range. I think a lot of people kind of struggle with this, is, you know, hey, here's good cold weather. I saw, you know, deer during late season, but I never saw that one really good deer. You know, sometimes there's cold fronts that, you know, they come, they go, they're quick. But, you know, if a deer, if it's later into the year, they found a different food source, they've keyed in differently or built back up some reserve to their whole body mass, they may not have to feed as aggressive or as heavy as you would expect later on because of this time window right here.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's well put, and that's kind of, I mean, everything that we keyed in on. And man, what a hunt that was. And I don't even know, you can call it luck, whatever you want on that hunt. Because I can't even really explain what happened, why it happened. It's one of those things that I'm still trying to figure out. Just thinking about the way this hunt unfolded, and sure, you know, I put it together with, trail cameras, kind of the area that he was using, but what happened was very unexpected. The way it all unfolded was very unexpected. What I witnessed was I mean, I think we've decoded it to a degree. I'm not 100% sure we're really going to have all the information. We may in a couple of years why it happened like that, but wow, what a hunt. I mean, it was just off the charts from all-time number one. That was the number one whitetail hunt that I have ever been on in my life. I've killed some really nice deer. I've killed bigger deer than the one I harvested, and I will always remember this hunt. It's probably right now, good Lord willing, I'm going to have a better one, but right now that's number one, an all-time favorite hunt.
And that says a lot, because you've had a lot of great rut hunts. You've had a lot of great early season hunts, ton of great late season hunts. But right here, and this is that weird window that a lot of hunters, they kind of fade out. They're like, oh, well, it's not November anymore, but I'm just not gonna hunt. And that type of mentality can really miss a big window, as we're talking about, from a food source purpose, but also from, you know, some deer exerting and showcasing some unique behavior. And you saw that. And Chad and I, the same night hunting at a different farm north of you, we were seeing some kind of unique, cool stuff too. But again, if you're not out there and you just think, November's past, I'm done, you can miss out on this stuff. Ours was not anywhere close to the intensity or uniqueness that you were seeing. But don't be afraid that when that calendar flips over to December to not be in the woods, because there's a lot of really cool stuff that's happening. And I think you touched on it briefly, but will make you a way better hunter trying to be successful in December time frame than ever you could be just hunting November. From a woodsmanship,
right,
from a following food sources, from knowing the biology of the whitetail deer and what's happening, what's occurring there, what key areas that they're going to be focusing in on, all these different things makes you a much better hunter in December. But back to the behavior. Walk us through the hunt. What in the world did you experience in the tree just a few nights ago? And it was a northeast wind, 10, 12-ish miles an hour. I think it was about high
right.
of 40 or so, 41 that day. So really a good day to be hunting clear that you would look for in early December in our area. It was fantastic weather. So many of us were out trying to experience and be successful. But, boy, you had a hunt. Let's hear it.
So the turkeys, and you and I talked about this earlier, the turkeys is really what kind of put me back here in this area. Following the turkeys, and that's what gave me the heads up that, hey, there's a lot of acorns here, because every time that I would go through this area, there was, I mean, wintering turkeys together. And we don't, some years we see it heavy and some years we don't. So there's probably a flock of 100, 150 turkeys Ooh. Wintering here. So that told me that there's a food source there.
For sure.
A good buddy of mine actually showed me that, and he showed me that by finding sheds in national forest.
Interesting.
He would literally, he uses binoculars, he'll go to ridges, he'll follow the turkeys everywhere the turkeys have been. Those deer follow turkeys, especially in forest scenarios. They're going to follow turkeys and go right behind them and pick up red oak acorn. They'll get right in the middle of them.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it from a forest, if you're in primarily forest-dominated landscape, really you're very dependent upon a mass production for food resources, especially during the wintertime. So you have to be open-minded to be able to correlate other animals and their food sources, what they're selecting, to possibly what whitetails may be doing. And you've done that. You talked about it pre-show, talked about it a couple weeks ago. And sure enough, here you are, same situation. Turkeys have rolled over these woods where you're at, and light bulb's going off.
Right. So here we are. Light bulb has gone off. And so I'm headed back, northeast wind. And we knew that's the wind that I needed to hunt. This little particular food plot that is tucked into this red oak, greenbrier landscape with a pond beside it historically, it's typically pretty decent, but it intensified because of the available mast and the greenbrier in there, and probably the lack thereof in the around landscape. What made the food plot attractive, and I wouldn't necessarily call it attractive, I would call it in the right spot.
Sure.
Is what I would call it. It's a natural travel corridor between two huge hollows. One of the hollows is on the neighbor. And what happened this year, uniquely enough, crabgrass was our friend.
Hmm.
And what crabgrass did was it actually allowed the wheat and the rye to kind of thrive after we sprayed it and drilled it kind of under that mat. It kind of protected it from earlier grazing. So it was up there where the deer could get at it a little bit better.
And crabgrass,
you put that with the pond,
dies with a frost and gets knocked
right
way back, and boom, now you've got pretty much just standing rye and wheat all by itself. Everything else died out underneath of it. It's like swapped places.
Right. And I could see that in the trail camera picture. A deer would pop through. I could see all these deer throughout, all the way to the pond edge, basically, with the wood edge and the pond edge. I could see deer, and I'm like, boy, they're really moving through here.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got all the turkey sign. We've got lots of deer. I've got those deer traveling through there, and they just go through there, period. They're going, it's always, you know, when they're in that area, they cruise through that little, was a log deck, and we kind of enlarged it, but great spot. Took me 2 years to figure out, 3 years to figure out that I needed a northeast wind to hunt it. Mm. I tried every wind. I would pinball around it, trying to figure out how to hunt it, because the deer numbers back there typically are so great, you're going to get winded.
Sure.
Northeast is my best wind to hunt. So here we are, and you described the conditions. So I get there early. I leave at 1, and this is the funny part that I don't even think I've told you this yet. But so what I do, one of my strategies is complacency. As I mentioned earlier, as you mentioned earlier, I check the cameras almost every day. I love the Cuddy Links because they do save me time. But
yep.
I think it's important that your vehicle is on your road network, if you have one, at least once a week at a minimum.
Sure.
Once a week. Once a week is good. But in this scenario, I was running the roads, checking these cameras almost, I didn't miss very many, every day.
Yep.
And I was doing that for not only the information from the trail cameras and trying to catch a buck coming to a particular area and taking advantage of that December window that we talked about earlier, but mm-hmm. not only that, for complacency. So as I'm headed in, my first inclination is, I do this every time in late season when I have a wooded food plot in their bedroom. I drove the car right up to the food plot.
Yep.
Circled around it. By the way, ran the deer out that were already there because I knew they were going to be there. I knew it. It does not matter. Those deer, they cruise through there. They bed on the edge of it. It is their bedroom. I knew they were going to be there. Not only that, I knew that from the prior camera checks and scouting trips, I knew there was a butt ton of turkeys in there. And I was like, there is nothing worse than walking through turkeys when they're there.
We're trying to get to
they
a deer stand.
There.
Yeah, in and among turkeys is annoying.
Yeah. So basically I'm going to kind of free the way with something that they are used to.
Yep.
And that I keep the other deer used to in the area. So I go through and make my circle, drive back down the road to my parking spot. I've got the perfect wind. I get up in the tree. I'm like, oh, I got in here. The vehicle worked. This is great. This is one of those spots, man. When you sat down, it's on. I mean,
right.
I mean, you are there. This spot is in their bedroom. It's like coming to my living room and waiting on me. Mm-hmm. At some point in time, I mean, you're going to be there.
You're going to find Seth and that lazy boy. You're going to find him.
Yeah, exactly. So I get up in the tree, and I put the camera arm on, and I've got a double set there.
Yep.
And I actually brought the tree saddle because cover's gone.
Sure.
And
yep.
Just knowing the history, I need the saddle. I'm using the tree for my cover. I'm setting vertically. My body with the tree in my tree saddle, and I kind of use that. I've had success in the past. Need a blind there, and that is my sole intention, is to get a blind there for late season. So I get up the tree and I get set up, and I reach for my rangefinder and I realize I forgot it.
Uh oh.
Yeah, that's the part I hadn't told you about yet. So, I have to have the rangefinder. I can't judge yardage out of a tree stand to save my hide.
Yep.
I've got to have a rangefinder. I crawl back down the tree as fast as I can. I unzip my coat because I know that I'm getting ready to break a sweat because I know that I need to be back.
Right.
And I rush back. I get the rangefinder. As I'm walking up the path, there's a big rack right under the tree stand. I see it, and I'm like, well, I got one thing to do. I look up. I'm like, there's no point in standing here. I just need to walk as fast as I can, and I need to get that deer out of there. Hopefully it's not a shooter. I could see him through the woods kind of feeding back and forth. And I just walked, and he raised his head, and I saw him run off, and it was like a 130-inch type deer. Don't know who it was. Don't know anything about him. But
yeah,
I'm like, I've just rent that hunt. I'm like, I rent the hunt. He didn't blow, but he just ran out of there. And I get back up, and probably 25, 30 minutes goes by in the woods. The leaves are off, so I can see now in the woods for a long way. The sun's kind of beaming down through in different spots.
Yep.
And a lot of people think that they don't like that, but for me, it seems like when animals get in those spots, like they really illuminate,
man.
I can see them.
Yeah, it throws shadows, and it really catches your eye when light like that changes from, it's a big contrast, basically. Something blocks light or changes,
right.
It draws your eye real quick when you're keenly looking for something.
Right, and I get to looking, and the woods are literally just alive.
Mm.
The turkeys, I hear a turkey start to gobble. I hear hens start calking. You can just hear the turkeys just scratching, in the acorns. Just tearing the woods up. And I look and I just see deer cruising. I see one deer in particular that I know really well, Rib Crib, a nice 140-inch, a younger style of deer, which I saw him three times and had him in bow range during the course of this hunt. But I see him working underneath a red oak and in the green briars, and just deer movement as far. I mean, just everywhere you look, you could just see deer. I mean, and they're just here. And I'm like, wow, this is awesome. Well, does start to move in. A few does. This
yep.
is early on in the hunt now. So a few does start to move in, a family group. There was 1, 2, 3 come through first. An 8-point comes through, kind of runs these does for whatever reason. Runs these does, and they get out of there. Well, here comes Rib Crib. He just appeared. I'm kind of looking out here in the woods at the other commotion here, and here comes Rib Crib. And Rib Crib, keep in mind, man, this is a magnificent animal. I'm telling
sure.
you.
No slouch.
Anybody would want to put their tag around this deer.
Yep.
And he is acting just 7 shades of crazy.
Hmm.
This is kind of where the craziness started to happen. I did see a few more does in between this, and the does all left the area. But he was just... I mean, he's just in the food plot, and just all of a sudden, just like you switched, he just takes off running and runs over into the woods, back into the woods, like, you know, someone had shot him with a blowgun. And I'm like, what happened? I have no idea what happened. Just kind of standing around there and no idea what happened. And he cruises off and I see him just cruising, literally just cruising up and down in the woods. And I'm like, what is going on? Long story short, I lose him and a few more bucks come in. They begin to spar and fight around, and then they move off down to the pond, and you can hear those bucks just splashing in the pond, and
right.
They're running around the pond, and about that time, a few more bucks start to materialize, and a few more bucks start to materialize, and then at one point, before that I forgot, I'm going to back up a little bit here. I get busted by a doe that had came in.
The late season joys.
She took off. Yeah, when she took off, she busted me. And when she took off, man, I thought the hunt was over.
Yeah.
I mean, whitetails. I mean to tell you, whitetails in those woods. I could see her and a few other deer, but when she busted me and took off running,
there's
she got into
flags
those woods
everywhere.
And there, oh, I was like, we're over. We're
mm-hmm.
over.
You know,
it's over.
And I've had many, I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, late season, it's just odd. Yeah, you seem to get, you know, quite a few deer concentrating around a food source. But when you have that many deer, one being goofy, one acting weird, one being kind of on edge or spooky, it puts everybody on edge. And then it's the littlest of things that just blow the whole herd out. But then all of them are sitting back and wonder, once they're kind of like back into cover for 5 minutes, they're like, wait, guys, why did we get scared? And then they just start filtering right back out. It happens all the time when you big fields or big food resources and you just got tons of deer concentrated on them. It's weird behavior to see, but it happens a lot this time of year.
Happens a lot. I'd like to add one more thing to it that I have witnessed over the years, because this was a myth that probably got me down early and sent me back home a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When this doe did it that night too. Two does did it.
Oh,
the hunt was long, but a little bit later it happened again from another doe. But she stomped hard.
Yeah.
She blew a lot. You know, used to, I thought the hunt was over.
I have
when the deer stomped and blown, you might as well get down and go home.
Yep.
That's the furthest thing from the truth.
Absolutely. I've experienced a lot of that, especially when there's a chance that maybe there's a deer that might be in estrus, or there's a fawn that might be coming in. Honestly,
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times deer, especially buck this time of the year or earlier in November when you're hunting a lot and you get bumped, it just tells them, hey, I need to go check that out. There's deer over there. I can audibly hear there's deer there. I'm coming. And I've had it happen numerous times. And it's at first you're like, oh, man, I got busted. It's kind of discouraging. But then you're like, yeah, let me just wait it out and see what happens. And if you're patient and persistent, oftentimes things just settle right back down. They go right on back to doing what they do.
And that's exactly what happened on this hunt. The second one blew. And so this was the third time I thought hunt is over. So now we're back to where I left off.
Mm-hmm.
So now these bucks, the third doe that blew, that was the last doe that I saw of the hunt. Now these bucks, some of them had been in earlier and left. And one of them we call 7-11. He's a 7 point on one. He's got 7 mainframe tines on one side. Beautiful young deer, going to be a slammer. And then he's got 4 on the other.
Mm-hmm.
So we call him 7-11.
I think everyone was hoping for you to say 11 mainframe points on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's going to be a slammer. We're really looking forward to him. But he was one of the deer that ran off. So Rib Crib, he's ran off and he's acted goofy. And then all these other smaller bucks, they start trickling in. Some of them are playing down in the pond, and man, it's just I just start seeing bucks everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I look down and I don't know. There was so much going on. I'm having to sit so completely still because there's so many eyes around me, and I've already had two negative experiences being busted by does that I know that, you know, one false move and this show's over. Now we're getting down to lower light to where we're not going to have that recovery time from a spook deer for them to regroup and come back in daylight hours or however, you know, whatever the case may be. So I'm sitting extremely still and few more bucks come in, and then I look down and I don't know how Rib Crib got back in, but I look down and Rib Crib, he's 20 yards just underneath of me, and man, again, he just cruises right through and leaves again. And I'm like, what is crazy deer doing? Maybe he was cruising for a doe. I don't know. Here comes a beautiful 8-point that I know well. I haven't named him yet. 4-year-old, he comes in. This is the only deer that really came in and ate wheat.
Mm.
Wheat and rye. This deer, he came down and he came in. The whole time he was there, I kept looking over at him and he was eating wheat and rye. And he's a part of the story. Big body deer. Beautiful deer. I forget how many 8-points I saw. I saw a few small 10-points. But age class that night, I saw three 4-year-olds that I know of.
Wow.
A handful of 3-year-olds, a lot of 2-year-olds. So all these bucks are trickling in. I know most all of them. Oh, I did see another giant. I mean, just a slammer that I don't have a picture of. He stayed in the Red Oaks.
Gotcha.
Probably an 80. Oh, my TV came back on. Hold it.
Pause the entertainment.
Yep.
Needless to say.
There you go.
There is a ton of deer hanging around this back section in the Red Oaks. And I know we've talked a lot about it. But yes, you are hunting over a food plot. However, the deer aren't in there actively feeding. They are, the majority of the game species are in the oaks. It's so incredibly important to know oak species and know when they are most preferred, because I don't care if you are in crop country or really where you're at, oaks are extremely beneficial and extremely attractive food resources. It's part of the native the native food resources that are out there, and that you need to be keen in on and knowing when to hunt them. And this is a prime example. Yeah. You have other options on this farm that are, let's say, would be in most people's eyes more attractive to hunt over. But right now, this is what you need to key in on. You cannot forget about acorns late season in timber country.
No doubt. And there again, you made a good point that this really wasn't an active food source that they were at, per se. Obviously, the oaks were, and some of the other species in there from the logging operation and things like that that we've done. But what I do think was really natural to them, we had a few other calling cards. So we had the wheat and rye as a calling card. We had the pond as a calling card. Several deer use the pond while this was going on. They always use that pond. So we're in a big wooded area. And I think it's natural this time of year for them to feed and then move to a more, in our area, a more open area as night falls.
Correct.
Maybe. I mean, I feel like that's what was happening, but this was such an odd hunt, I just can't place my finger on what was happening. So all these bucks are moving into this. And I mentioned the age class that I had saw. So surprisingly enough, I've got a group of bucks that are sparring / fighting, getting pretty cranked up down by the pond. And then over to the right of them, in the other corner of the food plot. I have got another set of bucks that are sparring. And then directly below me, I have another set of bucks that are sparring. I had a total in my head that I counted of 27 different bucks.
That's unreal.
That I saw now.
That
there
whole
was yes. Mm. That whole evening, roughly in the food plot at this time while these bucks are sparring, in and around close to proximity. And I wasn't 100% sure, but I've got, you know, between 14 and 16 bucks at this time.
Unreal.
Rib Crib came back through. And then I hear, and it, like I said, it was a still night, one of those nights, the leaves were, you could hear deer walking.
Right. From quite a long ways off.
Back to the right. Back to the west. I'm watching all this unfold, all these bucks. And if the thought came to me, I'm like, where are the does? There's not a doe in this food plot one. Mm-hmm. I cannot find a doe. And I begin to scan and look with binoculars as easy as I can. You know, I kind of got the tree saddle and I kind of got my elbows just hung on my belly and I'm just barely trying to look. And I'm like, just got it. Where's the doe? Why is there not a doe here? And then I hear a deer coming from the west. Keep in mind, I've got a northeast wind. That is where the slammers always come from. And that they want to know. They want that wind.
Sure.
My scent was blowing. Man, I feel if he would have been 40 more yards back to the north, the west, the east, he would have gotten.
Hmm.
But he likes to use that crosswind to come into me. And I looked, and when I caught him, he was just standing there. I'm like, that's him. I could see his bases.
Right.
And I pull up my binos, and I look, and I'm like, that is him. It seemed like 15 minutes was probably 8-7, and he never moved a muscle. He watched.
Wow.
He watched everything that's happening in that food plot.
You know, I don't mean to take you away from I don't mean to take you away from the story, but it kind of makes you wonder how many times does that really happen. You know, you can see a long ways. The timber's relatively opened up now after the TSI and several years of you know, that canopy getting kind of closed back in, looking at harvest. So, you know, it's pretty open timber. But, you know, how often do we not see a mature deer do that before it enters and commits into an area? They're just surveying the scene, figuring everything out, interpreting it, reading everything, who's there, who's not, kind of catching, probably catching a little bit of the wind of what deer are in there.
Definitely.
But how often does that happen? You know,
more times than we know, and that is why a good stand location that has cover is so important.
Absolutely.
Or a blind is so important, because I'm pretty confident some of those big old bruisers that have played the game, they know, and they back out is what they do. They back out. I've seen big deer actually hunker down and reverse step backwards.
Yep.
I mean, I have seen them do it. They played the game. They know what's going on, and it's like, okay. Keep in mind, now I've seen them blow, but I have seen them actually sneak out and not blow.
Oh, yeah.
AP.
Yep. I've seen the same thing.
So you're exactly right. I mean, that's what they do, and that's why it's such a good set. And, you know, these cell phones, they probably save a lot of deer lives, I'm sure of it. We're looking on our phones. And,
sure.
You know, Rib Crib just slipped in, and we're like, whoa, hey, where'd you come from?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, anyways, I'm watching, and he's watching intently. And, I mean, he is focused on what's going on. He is scanning. He is looking. He is just assessing the situation. I'm not so certain he's going to come in. So remember, we've got three different bucks fighting.
Yep.
We've got a few just kind of watching the fighting going on. I've got this 8-point that I know well that I haven't named, and this deer is just intensely eating. I've got some other deer bucks out in the timber. They're eating acorns. I've got a couple deer down in the pond. They're just, I don't know, sound like ducks in there, and I would slowly look at the corner of my eye, and they're splashing, and but these are all bucks. He finally commits. There's these bucks that are lower. They really are getting with it. One of them aggravates the other one, and I can't really move, and there's so many deer around me. I'm just really looking from corner to corner, just assessing everything that's going on and kind of trying to take it in. And one of them smacks the other one really hard, and he gets mad and pushes back hard, and then he snort wheezes. And when that buck down there snort wheezes, I look back at the corner to the west, and I see his tail go flip, flip, flip. And I said, okay, he's made his mind up. He's going to do something.
Yeah.
And he starts to walk. And he starts to walk back towards the south, and there's a couple cedars, and he goes behind the cedars. And I'm like, he stops, and I'm lost, and I'm like, oh, dang, he didn't want anything to do with what's going on here. Not sure why.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he then comes and turns and starts to head right towards the food plot. When he gets to the edge of the food plot, that 8-point that was eating, he put a target on that thing. And I tell you what, I've never seen anything like it. He put a target on that thing, and he ran as hard, full throttle. This buck was eating. He did not know.
Right.
He ran full throttle. I mean, big, heavy, nice 8-point, physically fit, long, I mean, beautiful coat, big muscles, up body, butt. And he looks up, sees Dirty Harry coming at him. He lowers his antler to catch the blow. Dude, it about knocked me out of the tree when the antlers hit. Bam! He never stopped pedaling. He pedaled him all the way to the end of the food plot, down by the pond. The deer flipped. When he flipped, he tried to gore him in the rib cage.
Unreal.
I mean, it was the craziest thing that I have ever witnessed. He then comes back out, runs another buck up in the woods. Some of these bucks are just on the edge, just standing in awe.
And fear.
I'm like, he's not coming back this time.
Yeah.
And then he comes back. So during all this commotion, back to the west where he came from, there was two other bucks that kind of ran off to the side. Well, he comes back into the food plot, and he's just kind of looking, and he stops for a minute. I range him, and then those other two bucks over there, he starts putting a bead on them. And I'm like, it is now or never.
Yeah.
And I had to shoot him walking, and I drew back, and I knew I'd ranged him at 30. I'm like, he's still 32. I'm a 30-yard pin. He's walking. Thump. I heard it. I mean, just sounded like he went right through a pumpkin. Thump.
Right.
And I thought, I just knew I'd hit him back. I just knew that I was devastated. I thought I hit the deer back. I gut shot him is what I thought.
Right.
Through all the adrenaline and all the commotion going on and just being in that scene, it was really hard to just process and keep everything going and make the right moves and the right decisions through all of that that's going on, and keep your eyes on all these other deer and everything that's going on. And anyways, I was like, I got to give the deer time. I got down probably 10 minutes earlier, and I picked my arrow up. I smelled it. I'm like, a little bit of gut, but man, look at the blood on this. So I was hopeful, but I'm still going to wait.
Yep.
To be honest with you, my gut, I know they always say to trust your gut, but I thought that this was going to be a long, hard blood trail is what I thought.
Yep.
But we recovered the deer, I don't know, between 50 and 75 yards from where I shot him, and he was laying, and I mean, just blew my socks off. What a magnificent hunt. And I still really don't understand everything that was going on that night.
Couple things. How long did you give the deer before you went up and took up the blood trail?
Oh, we gave him 6 hours.
6 hours. So went in late that night, took up the blood trail. You found him right there after pretty much just a touch of gut and probably a heck of a lot of liver.
Liver is what, when I pulled him out, when I gutted him, liver was liver.
Yep.
It was liver. Liver was decimated.
Well, and here's another just something to tip to chew on, guys. That same night, Chad harvested a doe, straight liver. She ran hard for 60 yards, slowed down, and we were hunting a large field, so we could see all this. She ran hard, 60 yards, slowed down, stood still for 5 minutes, took 10 more steps, stood for another 7 minutes, laid right there, and died. 2-inch expandable broadhead, straight liver, broadside, 35-ish yards, and... if you're going to punch him in the liver midsection, I would always opt for a 2-inch expandable. But it is a very lethal shot. No one's intending to do it. However, if you don't go and run in and bump that deer, if you give that deer time, it is 100% lethal shot. And typically 100%. Speaking, it is a first bed or a second bed that – the beds are probably 20 yards apart, maybe, and you find 100%. Them pretty quick. If you just give them that time, it's going to die, but just know that's the right move. Luckily, we saw the deer die 10 minutes after the shot, but err on the side of caution, 4 hours, 6 hours go in, the deer is going to be there. I've seen that play out both ways where it was, I don't really know, you find out later, probably liver, or you get tracking that deer and you're like, oh, guys, this is too dark of blood. We're not getting the pink. We're not getting the bubbles. We need to back out. You go back in. You give them time. Sure, they're maybe 100 yards in a bed. But if you're getting that liver-ish feeling from a shot, that's the card to play. The patient, and you
let
will find
go.
Out. Yep.
And you made another good point. If you go in after them, I don't know this, but they can, when you bump them and go after them, adrenaline kicks in, and adrenaline does something to those things.
And they can go. Yes. Yes.
I mean, you know, so that's the deal. And I mean, 100 yards, even if they went 75 yards, they go in the right direction. I've seen guys, you know, we're in the thick stuff. You can walk around for days and have walked right past a dead deer 10 times.
Oh, yeah. It's very possible. Very possible. Yeah.
So you've got good blood from a liver hit. If you don't bump them, and they'll be right there.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And if you're using, you know, that 2-inch expandable, it bleeds a lot. And it bleeds a lot internally. But if you have a pass-through, you have a good blood trail follow, but just know that you're going to follow it 4 hours after.
Right. Yeah. Very, very good. Very good point.
So you saw incredible, incredible behavior in out of Dirty Harry, a buck that was extremely aggressive. And something that, again, people who are opting to sit out during December, they're going to miss out on this. They're going to miss out on identifying incredible food resources, bucks coming in, still displaying some unique behavior from sparring, from straight up fighting to consuming acorns heavy, you know, rebuilding their bodies, getting that fuel, getting that energy, getting them through, preparing for the brunt or the potential, the brunt of winter to come. It's a really unique time to hunt. It sounds like you saw just about everything a hunter could experience the first couple weeks of December right there in one evening of a hunt.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I'll ever see anything like that again. And, you know, you and I have talked about it. I mean, maybe it was just the concentration of deer and the testosterone in the air. I mean, maybe there had been a hot doe go through there prior, and we know it, we're getting to post rut. We do know that. So
right.
you know, whatever the case was, all I can tell you is if I would not have been in the stand, I would have missed a phenomenal, phenomenal night in the tree stand. And when we skinned Dirty Harry, his body, it looked like a map, man. I mean, you talk about punctures.
Wow.
You talk about scars, his front left shoulder. It had a hole in it. It was either from a tine, my guess is it was from a tine, or a bullet, I'm not sure. But I could take my index finger and stick it, after I peeled the hide back, I could stick it, oh, probably an inch and a quarter, inch and a half, inside of his shoulder, and then feeling that shoulder, man, it felt like a plate of iron, and then just the other scars, and at one time, he had had his eye poked, you could tell that.
Wow.
You know, the other, I mean, the deer was just, I don't know, man. He was just an absolute, he was his name. He was Dirty Harry. That's what he was. He was a villain.
Fitting name for sure. Man, that's wild. And you talked about it earlier. You talked about one of the key things that, you know, you knew as soon as you saw this deer that it was him. That's one of the things that we talked about and ultimately really kind of attracted you to the deer was the fact that this deer had just some incredible bases. And when you talk about incredible base, we're talking, you know, 8-inch bases on both of these antlers, left and right. And so just an enormous set of antlers on this deer that's just super impressive. Very uncharacteristic for our area to have mass to that degree. But man alive, what a whopper. And so all in all, you know, let's just say gross score. What does this deer tape out to be rough?
I mean, you're talking without his extras, you're going to go 155. You add the extras, you're going to get 163, 165. He's got a drop time. Got another flyer off the right side. And he's got another flyer that you can't. The pick, this is one of those deer that the pictures don't do it any bit of justice. I mean, sure, he looks good in a picture. But once you get up to him and you start just looking at the characteristics, you're just like, wow. I mean, look at that flyer. Look at that.
Wow.
Look at the bases, just huge points off the bases, all the nutrients and energy he put on those bases. And here's what I can tell you is I don't think there's a deer in the woods that could break him off at the base.
Ooh, my gosh. If there was.
You know, there's a deer over there, a giant, older deer, non-typical deer.
Yep.
And he's busted off right past the G2 and had his 3 weeks ago, had his eyeball just hanging right out of the socket.
Yep.
I don't know who did it, but I feel like I have a pretty good suspicion who did it.
Yeah, you took a little revenge for that guy. My gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no telling, but man alive, what a fantastic deer. You know, and kind of a complete story. Like I said, I think it's kind of important to put a timeline on things of, you know, there's a little bit of history with this deer from a couple of years ago. Now that you know, you're able to put your hands on them, put the pieces together. But this deer showed up 2 weeks ago and really kind of caught your eye, kind of debated, man, is this the second tag I'm going to fill this year on this deer? He's very impressive, but I think when you get him on the ground, he's even more impressive. Looking him over, like northeast wind, that's the place and time to kill him. 2 weeks later, here you are. But through that time frame, there was, again, that intensity and aggressiveness of getting as much intel on the deer, that specific deer, but the general deer herd as well, as to where that food resource was, because it wasn't on the buffet, which was different for many years. But you had to know to be able to make the right approach and make the right game plan. It all came together, but again, guys, all that intel that you're getting from the summertime and you know, that last part of summer as deer season comes in, that's important, but does not tell a complete story of what's going to happen and transpire as deer move, as deer, you know, change their patterns, food resources change throughout a given season. You've got to be able to adjust on the fly. and make those changes and adapt to the conditions. And this is a perfect story of that. Don't just adapt during October or November. You got to adapt during late season too. Prime example. Right. There's 160-inch deer dead now because of that aggressiveness, but it's a calculated aggressiveness too. It's not just a willy-nilly tramping through the woods to find some fresh sign. It's identifying, okay, there's a good deer in this area. I don't have the complete picture. Let me strategically go in because I know that the TSI in this area likely is resulting in an abundant mass crop of the red oaks. Sure enough, turkeys are in there, squirrels are in there, tons of sign of wildlife. The only place, the only time to get in there and hunt there is the northeast wind from the past years. Boom, boom, comes together. There it is. And I don't think you can ask for a better story of a whopper, whopper deer.
And I don't believe in luck, if you will, but I'll tell you what, I didn't expect that type of hunt.
Yeah.
And those deer just to be there and react.
Sure.
Like they were. And my son, he's kind of learning that. He's got a tag left. And
yep.
We're hunting a deer right now. Well, a couple of deer. We're not just going to hunt one deer with him yet. We're going to hunt a mature deer. That's kind of our goal.
Yep.
And I know not everybody can, you know, plan days and pick that exact right cold front day.
Sure.
But what I'm trying to teach him is right now in late season, during the rut, I urge if you can be in a tree stand, be in a tree stand. But during late season, if you can at all, you know, pick your days, especially this later half of December, after they get replenished, if you can at all pick your days, pick them around the cold fronts, and if you know where a good food source is, don't burn it out.
Sure.
Don't burn it out on a hunting-wise. You can drive in there, in my opinion, check your trail cameras, do what you need to do there, but as far as a hunt, when you have to exit that field,
yes.
When deer are in there, pick your better day. When you do hunt, stay late. Let the deer feed. Let them have had a safe experience, if you can. I know you got to get to dinner with your wife or whatever the case may be, but let those deer feed out. Get full and not have a negative experience, why they were there. And it may, if you can key in on a late season food source, you can sure kill a slammer.
The best part of season, in a lot of people's opinion, when you prepare, when you scout, when you know what to do, we're getting into that, in my opinion. A lot of season left for sure. So don't think it's over and it's done. You missed opportunity. There's a lot of season left for sure. So, Seth, I appreciate it. What a story. What a fantastic just full on breakdown of this hunt for Dirty Harry. And I hope that people, just from a hunting strategy standpoint, again, pick up on the fact that sometimes you just got to do what you need to do, and you got to get in there, be smart, be aggressive, be critical of what it is you're doing, and think outside the box sometimes when from a food resource. It's not all about standing grain or food plots right now. It still can be a lot of heavy native browse or just native food resources. When you're managing for ample food, native food resources, you're going to be hunting them
right,
even during the late season. So, fantastic story to explain all that and give that real life scenario. So appreciate you getting on and sharing it with us tonight.
Oh yeah, that was a blast, and I appreciate you for sure.
No problem, man. Well, I'm sure we'll have some more stories here in a little bit. Hopefully Trace will get a fantastic deer down, and we'll be able to share that
one with the bow.
I love it. I love it. That boy is determined.
He is determined.
Wonder where he gets that from. Well,
I'm trying to teach him. He's wanting to hunt every night. I'm like, we can't hunt every night. You got to wait for the right weather fronts now.
That's it.
That's where we're at. We're transitioning.
That's right. Well, he's got a lot to learn because he's a young hunter, but a lot to learn too, because he's got a good teacher there. So we appreciate your time, Seth, and we'll catch up later.
Okay. Thank you, Matt.
Well, there you have it, guys. You know, Seth is a extremely experienced deer hunter, and you know, has just seen this property work so much for him, and has so many years put into understanding how deer move throughout the property and utilize the property and its resources, when to strike and when to go in, when not to, when to sit back and watch and observe, and I think that that plays a lot into the success that he has, and I think that it also is a good illustration of knowing your property and knowing the resources that are available, and not only that they're available to be managed, but when you do manage them, how the deer are then going to respond. And I think that that is ultimately, when we're talking about habitat management, in a nutshell, that is where, as a from a hunting aspect, where we all need to get to, and knowing, again, the resource, how it should be managed, when it's managed, how it should be hunted. And this hunt itself for this buck was just a fantastic story. And a lot of times, you know, sometimes you just got to think outside the box and know that there's times in the windows when a lot of people are out of the woods and really kind of miss opportunities from understanding just the biology of deer and what is occurring in their life, not necessarily your life. This is a busy time of year for a lot of people. You got a lot of family stuff, you got holidays and whatnot, so it's an easily overlooked time period to be successful. You think that, you know, deer just kind of disappear because they're not running around like crazy in the rut, but this is the time to be very successful, and Seth has proven that this year and many, many prior to that as well. So, guys, hopefully you enjoyed the podcast, and you'll head over and listen to Kyle and Frank as well on the other podcast this week. Guys, we'll be hitting the road here very, very shortly, most likely next week. We'll have some wrap-ups and some property highlights to be talking about. We've got trips to Northeast Missouri. We've got a couple to Kansas. We've got West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky. We're going all over the place. So we're looking really forward to this and this window to be able to share these experiences with you guys of how we're going in and managing and assisting other people, other landowners across the country. So be watching for those updates. Be watching for some vlogs to drop as well as we're touring these properties. So guys, thanks so much for listening. Go and like and subscribe to all the pages, whatever you can do on them. Like them, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. You got any questions, please go and email us info@landlegacy.tv, or interested in our consulting services, go and click the consultation tab on the website, landlegacy.tv, and send in an inquiry, and we'll get with you. Guys, thank you so much. We'll see you next week. Yeah.